you already know how this will end.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marcia Gessen, who is a journalist and author of several books. She has contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granta and Slate, among other publications. She is the editor of a popular science magazine and lives in Moscow and is the author of the new book, Just Out, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marcia Gessen.
Thank you.
And already it's no surprise that Putin will be elected as president. Apparently, there are many reports of carousel voting in which busloads of voters are driven around to cast ballots multiple times. And apparently, they've given them little armbands or ribbons or ways to identify them. And then the election officials at the various polling stations hand them ballots of people who are not likely to vote. So that's just one of the many tricks underway. I guess none of this surprises you, right?
I'm a little surprised at the scale and the obviousness of the falsifications. We knew there would be vote rigging, but we actually expected that most of it would be sort of technical, that it would be happening behind the scenes at the level when the ballots go from the local election precincts to the Territorial Election Commission, which tallies up those numbers. I actually thought that most of it would happen there, sort of behind the scenes. It's incredible. I mean, it looks like an actual agony of the regime, the way that they're being completely blatant about it, and also what's happening in the streets of Moscow today. The streets are lined with Interior Ministry troops. Hundreds of thousands of youth seem to have been bussed in for a celebration in the streets of Moscow today.
That's the Nashi group.
Well, it's the Nashi and the Nashi likes. I mean, we obviously can't identify every single person who has been bussed in as Nashi, mm-hmm. but they seem to be youths from the provinces.
So when you say it's brazen, I mean, isn't that the whole point of Putin? And which is why your book is so welcome, because for the longest time over the years, I've been talking to Russians about the death of their newborn democracy. And it's been pretty clear that Russia has become KGB incorporated and that Putin is a thug. And yet Western experts continue to make apologies for him, but yet he is so brazen. So that's the disconnect. His brazen actions, which are in your face and meant to signal to the Russian people that I'm the boss, and this pathetic kind of chorus of Western apologists.
You're quite right, and the Western media gave him a free ride for years and years. Actually, when the basic structures of the Putin regime were being put in place, his first four-year term, when he eliminated most elections, when he dismantled all political institutions, when he made the judiciary, when the executive branch swallowed up the judiciary, and when he killed independent media. While all of that was going on, the American press was writing about Putin as a democratic and as an economic reformer.
So was it George W. Bush looking into his eyes and seeing his soul? Did that send this incredibly negative signal that we're talking about?
Well, I hate to think that the American media only listened to the president in their coverage. I think that there's actually a series of unfortunate accidents and some institutional problems with the coverage. I mean, the unfortunate coincidence was that while a lot of the early Putin stuff was going on, the American media were writing about the hung Bush-Gore election and had absolutely no interest in what was going on outside the country. Then 9/11 happened. Then Afghanistan happened, and basically all foreign coverage in the United States for a couple of years after 9/11 was focused on Afghanistan and then on Iraq. And Russia was just able to do its thing behind the scenes. For a long time, Moscow, which used to be a very important foreign posting for American media, became a way station for reporters working in Kabul.
And Masha, your new book just out, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, it's extraordinary that this very small-minded, petty, vain little man has been so powerful and so pervasive and has had such an effect on history and has been able to stifle Russian democracy in the cradle and albeit without much of a peep from the West. In terms of his vanity, though, it seems to me that may be his Achilles heel. I understand from friends like Nina Khrushcheva, the granddaughter of Khrushchev, and others have said that he had a plastic surgery recently, and which looks like they botched it, actually. And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back for the kind of Muscovites who are now protesting. Is that something that you can verify?
Well, I don't know that the Botox scandal was the straw that broke the camel's back. I think it was actually corruption and the basic humiliation and indignity of living in the Russian state. But there's... He looks ridiculous. He looks like, I'm not sure it's botched plastic surgery. It looks like he couldn't stop, like a lot of victims of plastic surgery. So he just kept injecting himself with more and more Botox. And it's not, it's humiliating to live in a country that's run by a president who looks ridiculous, in addition to all the other indignities. So I think in that sense, yeah, it's a contributing factor.
But that's not to make light of the brutality that he's meted out and the cynicism, the brazen nature of the blowing up the apartment buildings as a pretext to get into the Second Chechen War, the cursed the submarine, and then later the theater attack, which looks like a staged operation where he was totally in charge and didn't care about the lives of the Russian people in there, the innocent civilians, many of whom even brought up the Kursk in their last moments of life, didn't even bother to have the Narcan available, which is what they bring back heroin addicts with, because it's the gas that was being used was a state secret. Totally the mentality of a KGB apparatchik, and not a very distinguished one at that.
You're absolutely right. And I think that the brutality is sort of the extreme expression of what you feel when you live in Russia. You know, from the getting your passport extended or getting your driver's license to getting licenses for your business, you're always met with a complete disregard for human dignity and for human life. And the ultimate expression of it is obviously what has happened when it's come to violence. There's overwhelming evidence that the apartment bombings that cost more than 300 lives and that produced the first surge of popularity for Putin, who had been a virtual unknown until then, that those bombings were organized by the secret police. And that, of course, what makes the current situation, in addition to being very exciting because of the scale of the mass protest, also very scary because, as I said, we are seeing interior troops in the center of Moscow. The center of Moscow looks occupied from the pictures that people are posting on Facebook and things that people are saying to me on the phone. And there is, unfortunately, some chance of confrontation when people come out to protest tomorrow night. And I think there will be hundreds of thousands of protesters meeting with possibly hundreds of thousands of armed interior troops and also the tens or hundreds of thousands of provincial youths that have been bussed in to show their support for Putin.
So is there a possibility that a man who is basically a thug and proud of it, I mean, some of the language he uses in press conferences, like rubbing out the Chechens in the outhouse, and in his biography, he went out of his way to talk about how he was a street tough and all that stuff. And he clearly is enamored with that kind of swaggering thuggery. But he's also insecure, and unfortunately the West has given him a free pass for too long, and now the Russian people are basically saying the emperor has no clothes, and in many ways humor and disdain is a powerful weapon, but he strikes back by blaming everything on the West, just as he's used provocations at home to build his career and to kill innocent Russians. Is he likely to do something on the foreign stage if he becomes a pariah?
That's an interesting question. I don't think so. I mean, it's possible, obviously, can't be completely discounted, because his foreign policy stand, and really the only consistent foreign policy that he has pursued is wanting to make Russia feared by the rest of the world. But I don't see that that he actually sees the rest of the world or the West as an enemy that he would like to confront with arms. In some ways, he's kind of too small for that, and he's most concerned about what's going on inside the country. But I really would not discount the possibility, the probability of using some sort of provocation during the protests in Moscow.
So in terms of Navalny, one of the popular protesters who coined the phrase of United Russia being the party of thieves and swindlers, he's an ultra-nationalist, isn't he?
I wouldn't call him an ultra-nationalist.
Well, he's a nationalist, right?
He's a nationalist.
Right.
He's also a libertarian.
Uh-huh.
And more than anything else, he is a guy in his mid-30s who came of age around the time that that Putin had destroyed the media, the political institutions, and public discourse as a whole. And the problem is that's what you get when you have a vacuum of political culture. You get very primitive ideologies such as nationalism and libertarianism. I think it's too early to talk about emerging Russian politicians because most likely we don't know the names of people who are going to enter politics once it's actually possible to enter politics. And even though I'm extremely uncomfortable with nationalism and somewhat uncomfortable with libertarianism, I wouldn't exaggerate those fears quite yet.
But in terms of the window that you write about in your new book, Masha Gessen, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, when you describe it in your last chapter of personally being involved in the massive demonstrations that took place after the fraudulent election, which in many ways actually reminded me of what happened in Iran, where, you know, the middle class knew that their government was corrupt and distant from them, but it was just too much of an insult to have an election so brazenly stolen, and people came out. And you described that scene, and it turns out your partner's father is an important person in terms of what, vote monitoring? Is that what he does?
Yes, he's the mastermind behind Russian election monitoring.
Right.
I'm very proud of that.
But the point that you make in the book is that the very television station, the first one that Putin took over, one of the first acts was to get rid of Gazinsky and confiscate his network. They were reported on it fairly. So is it possible that you're going to have a little more honesty in Russian journalism?
We're having a little bit more honesty all around. It's like what we're seeing is the bottom rung of the pyramid that Putin has constructed being slowly dismantled, sort of brick by brick. State television is beginning to sort of get out of control. You not only see some excellent coverage for which some people have gotten fired already, but you also see some irony on the part of the news anchors. You see them sort of signaling unambiguously to the audience that they're mouthing a line that they don't take seriously. You also see things like the editor-in-chief of the Yaroslavl State Television Station writing an open letter to his boss saying, I'm taking sick leave until after the election because the election is making me sick. So that sort of thing is happening. We've also seen some heads of local election committees actually come out and talk about falsifications, honestly. And I think that once the dust settles down after this election, we'll also see that. Because what we're talking about right now is the unbelievable scale of violations. But I think we're also going to be talking about an increasing number of honest election officials on the local level.
So given the brazen activities of Putin and the connections to the murder of some prominent dissidents, I mean, obviously Anna Politkovskaya is one that we all know about. She was killed on Putin's birthday. But the poisoning of the Russian ex-KGB dissident in London with polonium, also Anna was poisoned with a poison that came out of the same KGB lab. And it also seems that even Putin's own mentor, again, which Western Russian experts always used to make the excuse of Putin, well, you know, he was a protege of the liberal Sobchak, the mayor of St. Petersburg. Well, it looks like Putin actually had him murdered as well by KGB poison.
This is true. Obviously, we don't have conclusive evidence on any of this, with the exception of the polonium poisoning of Litvinenko. The reason we don't have conclusive evidence is, of course, because the police and law enforcement in general are controlled by Putin, so none of the murders of the Putin era have been properly investigated, nor has Russia cooperated with the British investigation of the murder of Litvinenko. But there, the evidence is overwhelming simply because that kind of polonium is only produced by the Russian state and can only be released with the authorization at the highest level of government.
So what do you think is going to happen then in the next couple of years? And you're concerned about the next couple of days, Marsh, I guess, and given the presence of security police in Moscow, it seems like Putin is going to be kind of reviled and ridiculed in his own capital. But he still has a lot of support out there in the countryside. And I guess there are memories of some of the hardships that took place under Yeltsin. Do you think that since he's basically able to bribe the people into supporting him through oil money, at the moment that's it, the oil's up, but it may go down again. What's your prognosis on how this KGB incorporated form of kind of business thuggery that's going on in Russia, how much longer can it last? Is there just as you've mentioned in the media, there's a stirring of protest. Is it possible that within the entrepreneurial business class that Putin has largely stifled, is there likely to be a rebirth of energy there?
Yes. A couple of things. First of all, I think that the idea that Putin enjoys a lot of support outside of Moscow is not very accurate. There has been a lot of protest all over the country. There have been about 100 cities demonstrating simultaneously every time there have been large-scale protests in Moscow. The demographics of the protests are actually not, you know, overwhelmingly middle class at all. There are towns like the town of Kovrov, backwater of backwaters, population 145,000, with a protest of 120 people. Kovrov does not have a creative class, but Kovrov does have people who are fed up with living in the system, and that's really happening all over the country. Putin's short-sighted strategy of busing people in, forcing people to come out for protests in support of Putin is likely to backfire. There are now hundreds of thousands of people all over the country who have been forced to either spend their days off, standing in the freezing cold, demonstrating their supposed support for Putin, or who have otherwise been humiliated and had their will violated by being forced to engage in pro-Putin activity. So that's a ticking time bomb. And that points to a key difference of perception. Putin thinks that today is his victory day. It's the last day of the battle. He's going to declare victory in this election, whatever it costs him. Even though these brazen violations are apparently necessary for declaring this victory, and then he thinks it's over. But for the protest movement, it's really the beginning. I think that the kind of protest we're going to see tomorrow is going to be on an unprecedented scale. It's going to make the protests of the winter look small. So this is really the beginning of the battle, and I don't think that the Putin regime is capable of surviving it. The question is, will there be violence, and what kind of peaceful transition we can really hope for?
And you have to add a little insult to that injury when you mentioned, Masha, about the people who've been bussed in and told to vote several times. They were supposed to be paid by Putin's operatives, and many of whom pocketed the money. So not only do they get used, they get ripped off, which is kind of a metaphor for Putin's Russia, right?
Absolutely. It's the system in miniature.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us. I wish we had more time. Perhaps we can revisit you because there's so much more to talk about.
That's great, yes.
Again, I've been speaking with Marsha Gessen, who's a journalist and author of several books. She's contributed to Vanity Fair, The New Republic, Granter, and Slate, among other publications. Marsha is the editor of a popular science magazine in Russia and lives in Moscow. Her new book just out is The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a member of Occupy the SEC.